what's the difference between the two aspirations, getting rich and staying rich, and why it's important in the pursuit that you have in front of you?
Well, you know, Boogie Mail, I've been working with business owners since 1983, so I've had a chance to talk with thousands of them and work with a lot of them as well. And I think one of the things, and I've seen almost every, for lack of a better word, twist off that you can see. And one of the things I've seen is that when they're working in their own business, something they know, all right, they can control most of the things. I mean, I understand there's ups and downs, that sort of thing, but they can control a lot of things. They know that business. They pour, you know, many, many hours a week into it. They probably started with nothing, built it through. Then all of a sudden, you know, you have this sudden wealth when they sell it. And what happens, I think, when people have built wealth and all of a sudden they crank into just nothing but money, okay? I don't think they stop and realize that they are in a completely different world now.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest this week is Ted Oakley. But before I share with you more about Ted, I wanted to tell you that this episode is scheduled to release when I'll be flying over the Atlantic to Europe. I'll be speaking at an intimate conference with investors, and I will have a small book signing on the way. On another note, I see in my dashboard where the audience is listening from, and obviously the majority is from the US, but I have a long and growing list of countries where my listeners are from, and I counted 95. So each week or now and then, I'll mention some countries that are on the list where I have some listeners from, and I'd be curious to hear from you. And this week, I'm going to mention Tunisia, Nepal, Malta, El Salvador, and Jamaica. So if you're from any of those countries, go to my website, send me a quick note. I'm curious why you're interested in the podcast, what do you like about it, and anything else that you're willing to share about your story. All right. Ted Oakley is my guest today. He's the managing partner and founder of Oxbow Advisors. He has more than 40 years of experience advising high net worth clients in the investment industry. He is a frequent guest on Fox Business News, Bloomberg Radio, Cheddar TV, Yahoo Finance, and many more. Mr. Oakley is a chartered financial analyst and a certified financial planner. He's a member of the Austin Society of Financial Analysts. He's also a partner of Herndon Plant Oakley Limited, an investment company. He's a board member of Texas State Aquarium, American Bank, and American Bank Holding Company. Mr. Oakley is a United States Army veteran. Ted started his career in Dallas, Texas over 35 years ago. He's the author of 9 books on family wealth, staying rich, money mentality, and more. I'm including links in the notes to the episode. His primary philanthropic interest is helping children. A good friend based in Asia introduced me to Ted's son, Keith, who was kind enough to help set up this recording. My friend is both an inheritor and wealth creator himself and curious about the topics we discussed today. I soon discovered that Ted has interviewed my dear friend Jay Hughes, an advisor to wealthy families and author himself, who was also an early guest on my show. Today, Ted and I will discuss the peculiar challenges and opportunities associated with staying rich. We are reminded that any fortune that can be made can be lost. We talk about the importance of keeping family stories alive. Ted points out how there are over 1 million people in the United States with a net worth of $10 to $15 million. Yet, they drop out from this group regularly. We investigate the reasons. It's music to my ears when Ted emphasizes the need to have liquidity, idle cash on the side. We end with the topic of the next generation. Ted was a real delight to talk to. We found many overlaps with how we think at Sicard Associates and how his firm operates. I also learned a lot, and I hope you do too. Please help me welcome Ted Oakley. I also wanted to share with you that my book, Crisis Investing, 100 Essays, reached a top 1, 2, 3 position in some major categories in Amazon's new releases in finance, investing, stock investing, and portfolio management in the last few days. So thank you for that. The book is available on Amazon, and the Kindle version is still selling for only 99 cents. If you like it and enjoy it, please write me a quick review. The early reviews matter, so I appreciate it. Thank you, and let's get going with the show. Well, hello, Ted. It's nice to meet you. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Bogumil.
Well, as we spoke briefly before I hit recording, I read your books. I really enjoy your ideas and thoughts, and there's a big overlap between the way you think and your firm thinks and the way we operate at Seagard Associates. So I thought we could have an interesting conversation. And I know that you had Jay Hughes, a dear friend, on your show, and you had a wonderful conversation with him. So I know we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, thanks.
So I always like to start from the beginning, and I ask my guests about their childhood and upbringing, and I'm always curious how that time of their life they think shaped their relationship with money and led them to the career that they chose.
Well, that's an interesting question, Bogeyman, because I do think, actually I have a new book coming out in a couple of months that has to do with that. It has to do with the fact that a lot of what you think about money comes from how you felt about it growing up and what happened. And I really believe that. So what happens is, for me, I was very poor. I had, you know, really nothing. My parents never had any money. We had five kids and didn't have running water. I had an outhouse out back. And, you know, in order for me to even buy what was then an RC Cola or a Coca-Cola or a candy bar, I had to have some money. So at 6 years old, I started selling TV guides. And that's it. From then on, I always had to work. That's okay. That builds a lot for people. And by the way, I might tell you that there are so many wonderful success stories of people that had it much worse than I did. And even though we were poor my entire life and I had to basically leave home at 18, I just couldn't live that life anymore. But I've seen so many people that had similar lives, or they had afflictions of health, or they had just abusive parents and a lot of things. And, you know, so I don't feel special in that way. And that I think a lot of people have had to overcome their childhood. But the way it affects you when you invest is that if you grow up with, I've seen both sides, but if you grow up with nothing, okay, then money really means something to you. And what it really means to you is freedom. More than anything. And I think people that grow up without anything and they make money or build businesses or whatever, that's what they're after. You know, they're after freedom. And you could say security, but freedom is security, you know. And so I think that's part of what that, and I've noticed, and I have great friends of mine that grew up with wealth or, you know, middle class, different ways, and they approach it differently than I do. They probably are and in their investing days, they've probably been a little more aggressive than me, or maybe I'm always looking over my shoulder. I'm not always looking. I can choose investments and do a lot of things, and it makes you always look at what you want to make sure what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I know what could go right, but when you grow up with nothing and, you know, you go back to zero, it's just in your head. That's the way you do it. And I think a lot of business people think the same way.
I think Munger and Buffett say that they would never want to start from scratch again. And making that first $100,000 is the hardest. And they never want to go back to that moment when they have to start with nothing again. So there's a lesson there.
I totally agree.
And what shines through is the search for opportunity that we'll talk more about, and the risk aversion that you have that we'll talk about more. I just wanted to share briefly that I grew up in Cold War Poland, and there was no free market economy and everything was owned by the government. But as a kid, I thought that the whole world works this way.
Right.
So as a kid, you don't really know any better. And then at the age of 10, the Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall fell, and Poland opened up, and I saw a massive change in the country that boomed, and stores opened up, and the stock market reopened after half a century. So I got to witness 100 or 200 years worth of economic and financial history happen in front of my eyes.
Right. And when did you leave Poland?
I was 20 when I left. So I went to school in Brussels and in Paris, and then I picked up a book, One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch.
Oh, yeah.
And everything changed. I realized this is something I could do where I could combine my curiosity about history and people and numbers in one place and make a difference in people's lives in some way.
You've had a great trip yourself. I'm impressed.
But you grow to appreciate those lessons from childhood, I think, later on. And I look back and I see how I think in certain moments, as you mentioned, and I see that the roots of those mindsets go back to the age of 5 and 10 and 15 when I saw things happen. And I know that things can go up, but I can also imagine things going really bad. And that's why any investment we look at, I always start with how can I lose money first? And then I can get excited about the upside.
Yeah.
You mention in your books how there are so many books about getting rich, but there are very few about staying rich. And that's what you write about. Can you share with the audience what's the difference between the two aspirations, getting rich and staying rich, and why it's important in the pursuit that you have in front of you?
Well, you know, Boogie Mail, I've been working with business owners since 1983, so I've had a chance to talk with thousands of them and work with a lot of them as well. And I think one of the things, and I've seen almost every, for lack of a better word, twist off that you can see. And one of the things I've seen is that when they're working in their own business, something they know, all right, they can control most of the things. I mean, I understand there's ups and downs, that sort of thing, but they can control a lot of things. They know that business. They pour, you know, many, many hours a week into it. They probably started with nothing, built it through. Then all of a sudden, you know, you have this sudden wealth when they sell it. And what happens, I think, when people have built wealth and all of a sudden they crank into just nothing but money, okay? I don't think they stop and realize that they are in a completely different world now. Mm-hmm. It's not like what they were in. And it's a lot of them, it's hard to make that transition in many, many ways. You know, they have egos involved and they don't want to admit the fact that, hey, you know what? I knew everything about what I did, but I don't know very much about all about this money thing. Right. And I think that's been their biggest problem that a lot of people wanted to show me or show the world that, hey, I can do anything. I'm good at everything. When in fact, they're really not. And I think that's the problem about staying rich is they don't realize what the true end game is, what should be their objective. And that's the part about staying rich.
You share some of the biggest pitfalls to staying rich. And then you also share some common traits of the people that make it, that manage to stay rich. Can you share the two or some of the highlights?
Sure. Well, the number one pitfall is ego. Mm-hmm. These people are really good. They're great at what they did. Most of them are brilliant, smart. They know how to run a company. They probably didn't have any idea that they were going to have 50, 100, 150, a billion, whatever the number is that they sold it for. And so their egos get the best of them a lot of times. And they want to think that they're as good at everything else as they were in their own business. And a lot of times business is lucky. I mean, you could be a person that makes a lot of money and you just happen to be lucky. You're at the right place, right time. I think people forget how much luck plays into things. And when that happens, their ego gets the best of them. They do things that really they shouldn't do, but their ego says, you can do that. Don't worry about it. And the biggest pitfalls are these, and that is they step out and do things that they shouldn't be doing in this way. Let's say they go out and they fund three or four companies. They don't know anything about the business. They don't even know the people in the business. But they all of a sudden have negative cash flow, and so they start feeding. I call it feeding the animals. They got to feed these things all the time. And so that just eats up their principal that should be producing cash flow. And the other thing is one of their biggest pitfalls is that they buy too many things. I mean, you know, you could do a great life with $25 to $50 million, but you shouldn't be out buying a $10 million jet and an $8.5 million home in Aspen. That doesn't fit with that because you're going to have to produce cash flow to take care of all those things. You know, there's a way to do things. There's no question about it. But a lot of people don't realize they think that, you know, all of a sudden I've got $30 million, so I can do anything in the world. That's a pitfall because you can't, okay? But the people that do it right, I think, okay, number one, have a tremendous amount of humility. I think they understand that, you know, I don't know everything and I really need to learn a lot. I need to talk to a lot of people. I don't need to do a trial and error deal with my money. And I think that's the greatest thing about those people that have sold companies, and they feel like, you know, I'm going to try to spend a lot of time learning about the landscape here, the ups and downs, the negative, the positive types of people, whatever I want to do. And I think that that's where the good ones do well, and they spread well. They'll own some real estate, and they'll own some, you know, have stocks, bonds, pay a lot of cash. They're very widely diversified and in a safety mode, and they think before they really make a big investment. If something's going to take 5% of net worth, they'll spend a lot of time on it, and chances are they probably wouldn't do it, but they might. But that's the difference in those two.
Have you read the book Brewster's Millions? There was a movie, but there was also a book, probably 100 years old. It's a story of somebody that receives one inheritance from one relative and then the second one, and he has to lose the first one to get the second one. And within a year, and within that 1 year, he learns a lot about what it takes to lose that kind of money. And then he's prepared for the larger inheritance that eventually he's not even that interested in anymore. And I feel like people treat that sudden wealth as if there was a second one coming around the corner so they can piss on the first one.
That's true. I mean, I've seen it happen a lot of times.
And it may happen that it's true that there is a second relative with another inheritance coming your way, but usually it's not the case. And if there's only one that you can truly learn and practice with, then you should take it much more seriously. And it's a small book. It's much deeper than people think. I really enjoyed it. If you ever have a chance to look at it.
Well, you know, you have my interest up, and I've read a lot of books, but I've never read that one, Billy Millman. I'm going to get it and read it. Brewster's Million. Thank you.
It's a little story. In your books, you write about enough money that you will never run out. That's how you define being rich. Can you talk more about it? How do you know that you have enough that you will never run out?
Well, first of all, in my books, I know they're small, but I've always written books that you could read on a flight between, say, New York and Kansas City, or New York and LA, or Chicago and Dallas. I want business people to be able to read that book and get what we're trying to do. But when I say run out of money, one of the things I think people forget about, the final goal in investing is to maintain buying power. If you go back and look at people, and that's our goal with people, people will say, do you want to do this? You want to do that? Well, what you want to do is to be able 10 years from now to live the same lifestyle you're living today, and also whatever that took to stay above, even a few points above inflation, so that your buying power stayed intact. And that's what I mean when I say you have enough money for a lifetime. And I think where people forget about that is they forget to monitor that. That's a really important part of what they should be looking at. Have I maintained my buying power? Can I buy the same thing in 2023 that I could buy in 2000 now, or 2010, or whatever the time is? And I think that's the difference in what people need to think about in lasting money for a long time.
I had a conversation with the Great Depression historian who specializes in family wealth from that era. And one of the interesting things that came up that intrigued me was that the kids that grow up in a household that, let's say, has $100 million net worth then end up living in their own household that might have a 10 or a 5 million net worth. But you're smiling already. But they're used to a certain level of comfort and spending. So when the household net worth adjusts because of the divisions and so on, the expectations have to adjust. Do you have some thoughts about it?
Well, one of the things I've always said, and I think I have a pretty good handle on this, is that when the first generation has a lot of money, okay, they're going to have to really, really, really work hard to make sure that second and third generation makes it, okay? And they're going to have to make sure they learn some hard lessons. And I see it both ways, 50-50. Some people can do it and some people can't. And one of the things I've noticed is that if you're a family of wealth and you push too much wealth early on to your children, what happens with them is they haven't learned any lessons. So when they take that money, part of that money, which obviously if they're siblings, they're not going to get as much, and they start on their own, they're used to a different level, just like you're speaking about. And I think that's the big mistake that a lot of parents make when they deal with their children. It's like, I don't want my children to have to go through what I did. Well, I want mine to go through what I did, okay? They need to fail. They need to know what it's like to have to get back up and run against the wall, whatever. But I think that's the big problem, and you hit the nail on the head. They end up trying to live a $100 million lifestyle on $5 million.
The big theme that comes across in your books is that there is no money that cannot be lost. And you write, any fortune that can be made can be lost. And I often write that no money, no size of capital cannot be lost. And then we see those histories that even more recently when billions are lost in days. So I think the financial innovation went so far that no amount of money can be lost within a few days. Can you talk about it? It's such a powerful concept because some people think that once you reach a certain level of wealth, there is nothing that can get to you and there's no risk that's not acceptable. I think the opposite. There are some risks that are not acceptable even for the wealthiest.
Well, when you're like me and you have 40 years of experience with people that have sold a company, have a lot of money, okay, I really have seen every level that you can dream of money flushed. I'm talking about to zero. I've seen 25 million. I've seen 50. I've seen 250. I've seen 800. Okay. And one of the things I notice about those people is that they don't have a real appreciation for what it takes to put together that much money after tax. Okay.
Right.
So they do things. I mean, I've had people wire me, you know, 300 million, 400 million. And then 8-10 years later, we've got $10,000 in that account. Mm-hmm. And nothing to show for it, really. Everything that was touched was gone. And I don't know. I have a lot of ideas about that. But I think some people are just not comfortable with wealth. I don't know. I can't explain it exactly. But they're in a new land, a new place. And they're like, you know what? I don't really know where I am because I've always had my back to the wall. So I got to go back to that. But, you know, maybe that's just a personal opinion, but I've seen everything you can do, including breakups. And I have a Ted Oakley theory that if you want to know if a couple is happy, lay $40 or $50 million on them after tax, after selling that company, you'll find out if they're happy. Because one of the spouses, I take my half and I'm really unhappy at home, I'm taking my $25 million and going home. I mean, that's just something I've noticed over the years because we've had a number of them that have done that.
That's a very, very powerful idea and a test. Well, speaking of family, you write about the importance of family brand and family stories, right? So we're talking about the next generation, following generations. How do we make it last? Can you talk about that, the idea that the brand and the stories that the family shares are important?
Well, you know, but one of the things I've noticed over the last few decades, particularly, is that we've gotten away from it. Like if I'm a second or third generation wealth, I didn't necessarily see my grandfather get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and work till 9 o'clock at night every single day, have to borrow money, try to build that business. Obviously, it wasn't really, really big, but I didn't get to see that. Okay. And so with no stories about how hard that life was for them, I don't have a great appreciation for what happened. Now, I'll give you two sets of people that do a really good job of storytelling. One are Jewish families. Jewish families have a great way of talking to all the generations about those generations prior. And another one are farmers. Every farmer I know, and they're not big investors, but every farmer I know, their children are still on the farm. They're doing the same things their great-granddad did. Maybe in a different way, but the same thing. See, those stories go down through time. And then there are some brands, really, that you probably would never want to sell. I mean, if you have a brand that basically is a monopoly and locks out the competition, I'll take, for example, take a Budweiser dealership. I mean, or Coors. It needs something along that line. There's certain things that you just can't replace. So you want to keep those things. But I think what happens with a lot of people is they forget. I always recommend to people that have wealth. I said, do this for your great grandchildren. Write a small book. It doesn't have to be long. I can put them in contact with a number of people about your life, where you started, how you built all of this, how you made all this money. How much hard work went into that. They need to see that. If I go today and ask so many people, can you name me your great-grandparents on both sides? Very few of them can. They name one. Sometimes they name nine. That just tells me And nobody's ever talked to them about what went into all of that. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about stories.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It's a continuity of the family and the shared story that improves the chances of survival of the financial side of the family too.
Yeah.
In your books, you share your thoughts about business owners and you briefly talked about it. You mentioned how the majority of companies and families do better when the businesses are sold. I'm curious about that. And then you talk about the 2 years that follow the sale and that these 2 years are very important and challenging. Could you talk about that?
Well, one of the things I find, and just from my experience now, is that if the patriarch or matriarch that built this company, okay, and it's a great company, you could sell it for a lot of money, and a lot of times they don't have the capacity to look at their children and say, they can't run this business. I know they can't, so we're going to sell it. But in many, I've seen this in a number of cases where they say, well, I'm going to give them a shot. Okay. Well, if I take a $80 million company and I give them a shot and I have to end up selling it for $15 million, that wasn't fair to anybody because those children didn't have that capacity. Now, that's not 100% statement. I've seen second generation wealth children take a business to a completely different level. I have a lot of respect for that. Don't get me wrong. But when I say most of them, and I really believe this, most businesses should be sold instead of passed down. And that's just because I don't see those second and third generations being able to run that business. But it's not a blanket statement. There's a number of them that can and do, and they do a great job. So, but I will tell you that I think in general, okay, you need to really look at your children and decide, would they have the ability to run this company? And chances are, you might be better off in that case of selling the company. And then after it's sold, and I've written a lot of books about what happens to you after you sell a company, but one of my best, I think, is called Crazy Time. And it's about the first year, year and a half, 2 years after you sell a company. I mean, just think about it. You and your spouse and your family, that company's been around with your life for 20 years, 30 years. It was your life. It was everything. You have employees, you're the boss, your ego, people call you, everything's going on. Then all of a sudden, everything stops. Nobody needs you anymore because you're not at that company. They're not trying to sell you anything. They're not calling you for lunch. You're out here alone. And I think people in that particular time frame, when I call it crazy time, they will go do things to try to make them feel like they're purposeful when they're really, that's not a good purpose, like buying a bunch of companies that don't work or deals they don't know anything about. And that's why I say on crazy time, I say, hey, if you sell a company, why don't you just wait a year and a half? I always call do nothing, just earn some interest on it. And you need to really spend some time thinking and forget about everybody telling you, oh, you need to get invested in that. There's always investment. You don't have to worry about that. What you do have to worry about is starting to do things too quickly when you really haven't had a chance to find out who you are in this new life. And that's what I'm talking about.
The big lessons that I see in your books is that the new do nothing part, especially in that moment,
yeah.
Go slow if you're going to go. And then there's this illusion or aspiration that now that you sold the company, somehow you have to double or triple the money and you should act quickly and find those investments that are once in a lifetime and you can't miss them. I think it's a combination of things, but there's something so alluring to go in a direction that is completely unfamiliar and take risks that you're not really aware of.
That's true. That's true. I've seen it. I've seen people that they wouldn't be happy no matter how much money they have. And I think the problem with that is I've seen people do this. They've done nothing but make money and make more money and make more in their whole life, and then they die. And so you have to ask yourself, so what was my life for? Was it to enjoy? Was it to enjoy my family? Was it to fish? Or can I do something besides making money?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's the sad part about it. They don't leave any sort of legacy other than, hey, we made a lot of money.
That's very true. You share in your book how there are over 1 million people in the U.S. with a net worth of 10 to 15 million, and then over 150,000 with net worth over 25 million. But you also mentioned that somehow we lose people from both of those groups all the time. And you mentioned a number of reasons, from owning one single asset to leverage to family conflict. Can you talk about some of those reasons? Why don't they stay at the top?
Well, I'll start with this. It's interesting because I found this to be true with people. They'll start to think about their children, especially if those kids were in the business or anything like that. And so they have too many people living off one asset. And that really is a problem because you end up with nobody really getting where they need to go. You need to realize your kids are young. I mean, they can go make more money. They can do what they need. And they forget to think about themselves. That's one of the ways where they drop out of that mode. Mm-hmm. The other way is they're not very balanced in their approach. They have this idea, and Wall Street sells it to them. You know what I'm talking about, Bogeymail. They'll sell them this idea that, hey, you just need to be in the market, okay? Forget about everything else. Well, if your timing is wrong on that, a la January of 2000, for example, you're not in a place where you're going to be thrown out of the level you were at into a different level. And I think that's one thing. I do see a good bit of the single stock mentality. I mean, I've seen it over the years, and I've really cautioned people against it. They normally will not listen. I wouldn't say most of the time they won't listen. And I've seen some disastrous situations with it where they really had the world by the tail, but they refused to do anything. And so they rode the stock all the way back to nothing. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you some good examples now. I met with people recently that have, you know, $50, $60, $70 million worth of Apple. Mm-hmm. Now, Apple's a good company, but you want 90%, 85% of your net worth in Apple? Probably not. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to happen to Apple, but something could happen. And so I always try to mention that to people. I remember in Enron, we didn't own the stock. We didn't own anything in Enron, but I would tell people, hey, you need to sell that stock because the bonds are going down in price and the bondholders are smarter than the stockholders. And I said, you need to sell it because, no, I can't sell it because we made so much money on it that there's no way, you know, that I want to sell it. And I'll give you a good example in the state of Texas, for example. If you go to Houston, Texas, so many people, their great-grandfathers had Humble, which is now Exxon. I feel certain that I could take their firstborn child before I could get them to sell that Exxon.
So the lesson is to diversify. And, you know, we worked with some tech executives that had most of their net worth in a single company that they were really, you know, attached to financially and emotionally. And having all of their net worth in one company has played such a big role in the wealth creation part.
Right.
And now to transition to what we started with, staying rich, maybe having all of it in one single, even incredible company, might not be the best path. So that's worth considering. Speaking of being invested, being fully invested, Wall Street has this mantra of not missing the market, not missing the beat. You mentioned about the need for ready liquidity, and you share how ultra high net worth people have about a third on average of their financial investments in cash. Wall Street would say idle cash, that's not working. And as a firm, we like the idea of having idle cash, and it gives you options and dry powder when you want to act, and just a margin of safety. We call it slack, many words for it. But tell me more about that benefit of holding idle cash on the sides when there are all these other investments that people could be chasing.
Well, you know, for that book, The Psychology of Staying Rich, I interviewed a number of billionaires. And one of the things I found about them in general was they all had a high degree of liquidity. And I actually thought it was around 37, 30, when I just sort of factored it out, it was 35 to 38% in the financial side of what they did. And they would have private business and real estate. They had all sorts of things, obviously, being billionaires. But it didn't bother them at all to have liquidity. And I would always ask the question, why do you have liquidity? It was the same answer every time, Bogeymail. It was that, you know, we make our really, really big money when people are in hurting badly and cash is not around and we can buy things really, really cheap. Their answer to that was, that doesn't come along but maybe once or twice every decade, but it does come along. And when it does, that's how we have really produced tremendous wealth. And if you look at Warren Buffett today, at the end of 22, he had $122 billion in cash. And people say, well, he's not a market timer. I say, well, he is a price timer, though. If he doesn't have anything that's worth buying, he doesn't buy anything. And he hasn't bought a lot the last year and a half. So I think people forget about that. If that's okay for somebody with $1 billion, well, if I have $2 million, and I think it's a problem for people with small money, $2 million or less, they they think they have to really make it work because they want to get to 4 million. And they don't have the patience to say, well, I'm going to carry about a third of this, 30% of or something liquid. Because those days come, you know, you're in the business. Mm-hmm. They come. If you have liquidity, you can really make a lot of difference.
That's this idea that bigger fortunes are made in bear markets when the prices come down, when fear takes over. And Buffett talks about fear and greed. Be greedy when others are fearful. And the only way that you can be is if you have that cash available. Mm-hmm. And that's when you can really act and make a difference.
Well, on the other side of it too is you have to have you have to get out of a mode where you think you're going to lose everything. Like that when fear creeps into the investment side of what you're doing, you're basically finished because you can't make a logical decision at that point. And I think having a high degree of liquidity will always help you stay in that zone.
That's very true. You know, I fly small planes for fun. I enjoy flying, and my instructor told me once that once the pilot, a student pilot, gets taken over by fear, loses confidence, it's over.
Yeah.
And you can't really restore it. And I think that happens to a lot of investors through bull markets, bear markets. There are moments that we get tested. But if you lose confidence, you probably should step away. And I think that there's a lesson there. And we've seen it happen in the last few years when a lot of investors got tested by very difficult times of big bear market, big bull market, and something in between. So that's something really interesting about fear and confidence. You use two very helpful concepts, and I'd be curious to hear more. You talk about base capital and investment capital, and you think of them differently. Can you share a little bit more with the audience?
Sure. One of the things I've found that people do is they tend to put all their money together, so they don't think about it in tiers, what I call tiers of money. Mm-hmm. But there should be a tier one money, which I call base capital. That is what I call no touchy money. In other words, I'm not going to go put that in real estate or private business or the stock market or anything like that. It's going to be money that I know is always there. I won't make as much money on it. I do understand that. But that's the part that when push comes to shove and times get really, really bad, I always have that base capital. And I won't have to worry about that part of it, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's the idea that I'm never going to go broke. And if you have that there, it allows you then the investment capital side, which is the one you tie up for longer periods. It can go up and down. You know, a lot of things can happen to it, but it won't throw you off. In other words, if you have all your money in investment capital, and you start getting these downturns, whatever it's in, real estate or whatever, and you get downturns, then you don't have any ability to be logical anymore because you're thinking about the pile. Whereas if you have two tiers of money, yes, one tier that's base capital will always help you logically think about a different idea about risk. Risk then doesn't become all-encompassing to you. You can be logical about it.
We talk about the capital, the fortress that we manage as the money that our clients don't immediately need, but also the money that they can't afford to lose. And it overlaps with your investment capital definition. So if you can think of that part of your wealth in that way, right, that really opens up options that you can be patient, you can take longer-term views, but you don't feel pressure that this money has to be readily available in times of true distress. And that's the base capital that comes in that can play that role.
Right. That's true.
In your book that you mentioned, your money mentality, you mentioned something really interesting. You talk about considering how you really feel about risk and losses and gains to be more aware of how you operate as an investor. Can you talk more about it? I thought it was really interesting because these are concepts, but that we all respond to them differently as humans and as investors.
Well, you know, Boogeyman, I know you've seen this many times. If you look at the Wall Street, say, initial interviews with people, they all ask the same questions. You know, they try to get a risk level if you lose 10% or 20%. And to a degree, that's okay. But I think people, they need to ask a lot of questions to try to figure out what's my personal money mentality. Forget about Wall Street. Okay.
Right.
What's my personal money mentality? And it goes something like this for us. You know, if somebody had $10 million and we said, well, if you see situations where you could have invested and you didn't and somebody else made a lot of money, how much, you know, what level of regret do you have off of that? Or some, you know, you start to ask questions where they have to think about how they feel about it. Not just, you know, on losses or gains, but regret and bias. Are you biased a certain way? And I think one of the things we found with people, we spend a lot of time on that because a lot of times they don't know. They'll say, you know, I'm really conservative. And then they'll watch the market go up a lot, you know, for a couple of years. And they'll say, gosh, I wish I'd done, I should have been in that, you know. Well, right. Not if you're really conservative. If you really were conservative, you'd be a more balanced approach. Or they'll say, you know what, I'm really, really aggressive. And as soon as the market breaks down on them, they just come unwound. And what I'm saying is they didn't know themselves well enough to know what areas they need to be balanced in. And the other problem is that investors end up listening to other people. You know, they go to a dinner party or they're at a lunch with somebody and they say, well, I'm doing X, I'm doing Y, whatever. Well, you don't know what they're doing. I will tell you this. I've drowned out all those stories in the last 25 years because I've seen too many of them, all right? And, you know, and a lot of that is just, so they don't know themselves. They don't know how they feel about things. And so we try to ask them a lot of different kinds of questions, not just, you know, how do you feel about a 20% loss? Well, you don't like that, obviously, but we'll ask them other questions about, you know, yeah, why would your spouse feel if this happened? Or how would you feel if your spouse did that? You know, all kinds of questions about their money mentality of how they approach money. And then we can dig it out and try to get to a point to where we say, you know, I think we got it here.
I'm thinking of the idea, and I think J.P. Morgan said it, that when the neighbors are getting richer faster than you.
Well, that's true.
It's a source of frustration, and it can make us do things we later regret. But I don't know if anybody keeps a tally of it, but I think that there are fortunes lost just by chasing returns only because the neighbor was getting richer than you are and faster. And I'm immediately thinking of the idea of living with a new client through the first downturn. And we had the benefit of onboarding some clients months before the COVID pandemic and learning each other in a way, how they react to different situations and how they get more comfortable with how we operate in various situations. So legacy clients would say, I know exactly what you're doing. I just wanted to hear your voice in March of 2020. And newer clients obviously required a lot more handholding. But what do you think about living with a new client through the first downturn? Because all of that is hypothetical until it really happens and they look at the statement and they have all the questions for you.
That's true. I think, you know, for us, one of the is, you know, you have different kinds of downturns. And I'll have to tell you, we never expected 2020 with the COVID situation to end up like it did during March. But I will tell you that if you look at January 2000 and you looked at January 1 of 22, okay, both of those for us were much, much easier because we thought both of those were big super bubbles and everything was in a bubble. And that was an easier time for us because we could say, hey, we're going to be really liquid here, which we were in both cases, and it's really paid off. Mm-hmm. Now, you get into those markets like you're speaking of, or a 1987 or something like, comes out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what we've tried to tell people, particularly, number one, we like to have them balanced, not just in the market, but the part that's in the market, we always come back to Stabogamil and say, look, I want to sit down and spend some time with you about your companies. Now, we don't buy indexes, okay? We buy companies, all right? And we'll spend a little time and say, let me tell you about, okay, this is the management. This is what they've done over the last 5 years. This is how cheap this company is relative to what we'll do the next 5 years. And think about yourself as a business owner, okay? Forget about, I'm worried about what the market's doing, okay? You're buying a company that you can hold for the next 5 to 10 years that really is a great investment, okay? Not all of them are, I understand that, but most of the ones we try to buy, you know, we're going to try to be in a situation where, you know, they don't have tons of debt, they have good cash flow, good management. You know, obviously we have companies that go awry just like everybody else does, but we try to get those out of there. But when people are looking at bad times, if you can get them on a level where they understand I'm making an investment in a company, not a one-liner in the Wall Street Journal, then you're in a much better situation.
Mm-hmm. I like the sound of that. In your writing, I read about the next generation, and we talked about it quite a bit. You share, it's not about how much wealth you have, It's about how you're going to use that wealth to foster long-term security, tool partnerships, and an enduring legacy among the people who matter to you. Can you tell me more?
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest concerns I've had over the years from everybody that has a lot of wealth is if they think more about their children than any other thing. Okay, mm-hmm. They think about, number one, if they're doing it the right way, they're thinking, I don't want to give them too much money too soon. If they're thinking about, and then they think about this, and people don't realize this, but a lot of wealthy people think about, okay, I have two children, I have three children. It would really disappoint me if after me and my spouse pass away, if these children are in a war because one didn't get this and one didn't get that. And your friend James Hughes, that you know well, has always said, you need to keep it equal. I totally agree with it. And one of the things that I find that they worry about the most is that, okay, but, and I've seen it so many times where now brothers and sisters don't even talk to each other. They don't get together on holidays. And so what good did the money do? And the parents before that, those are the two things I think they think about the most. So the only people that can solve that are the American patriarch, the people that started this thing. And it takes a lot of work to make that happen. It can be done, but it takes a lot of work. And I think I've seen really great cases where they did a super job. Then I've seen so many cases that were a disaster. And it all started with those two people that had the early wealth. And I think when I say the future generations, I think there's a lot of teaching has to go in that. A lot of lessons have to go into that. And a lot of people try to jump that and just say, well, I'm going to give them, you know, a $10 million trust. They'll be okay. Well, not really. That's not what you want to do for them. You don't want to really give them anything early on. You want them to earn it. You want them to have self-esteem. You want them to fail and have to get past those failures. You want them to have to make money on their own. I'm not going to buy you a new BMW. I'm not going to fly you private to Aspen. You know, by the way, you're probably not even going to Aspen, okay? You're going to be working, all right? I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do with children, but people forget that they're doing the wrong thing. They're disservice to these kids when they try to say, I'm going to make life easy for you, because you're really not making life easy for them, if that makes sense.
Very much so. I'm thinking of something else I read in your books, speaking of the next generation, how the next generation often chooses a different advisor than the parents had. And we've been very fortunate that the families we worked with chose to keep us generation after generation for many decades. And we had the benefit of the trust of the next generation. But then you also mentioned that the failures that happen to the wealth, they're not usually generated by the advisor, but the family choices and all the other mistakes we talked about. Can you talk about the two ideas, the one that the next generation changes the advisor is not the source of trouble, but all that change and all the other things that we talked about can actually lead to the demise of the fortune?
Well, you know, if you look at your firm, for example, you have all different ages, which is really good, because if you have a firm, you know, and in my firm, we have ages from 20 to my oldest employee is 89. So we've got every single decade. And I think firms need to have that so that as you go into the next generation, they have people that are their own level they can talk to, because if they're sitting there talking to somebody that's in their 70s, they're thinking, well, wait a minute. They're not going to be around when I really need great advice. And so those people need to be able to talk to people in their 30s or 40s or 50s, you know, something along the same line. I see firms that don't keep that in mind. Your firm does. And I think the good part about that is that you can maintain a continuity then with a younger generation, because then they'll respect what you're doing. One of these things about just showing up, you know, about, hey, let me tell you how to do it, youngster, that won't work, okay? They have their own mind, their own money, and you need to respect that, okay? And you need to find out what's right for them. And so we really try to match up people with the certain ages that they are. And it's worked really well, and I think it's worked well for you too.
The one thing that we've done over the years was to invite the younger generation to spend the summer with us, even just a month for a few weeks. Yep. And in many cases, obviously, they didn't choose any career that has anything to do with investments, but those few weeks gave them the vocabulary and the confidence to ask the right questions when the time comes. And I'm 42, and I've been with the team for, you know, 18 years now. And some of the kids that were interns when I started are now responsible for some big decisions for the family. Yeah. And it's really rewarding to see how the conversations that we had a decade or two ago are paying off now, and they feel empowered to have a conversation and know where to go with it. And
well, you know, Bogeyman, I think that's one of the great things you do. I mean, I think I give you kudos for that, because we, for many, many years, we probably have 6 or 7 interns in the different offices every summer. And some of them come from investors, and some come from other places. But I think there's two things to that. Number one, they understand what your firm's doing. But two, I think you help a kid understand and how to get their feet on the ground. So when they do go, we've had some tremendous successful kids that went on to be, they're in big parts of the world now doing great things. And, you know, what did we do? We taught them how to use a Bloomberg, you know, things like that. And all of a sudden they, you know, you feel good about it. You don't know all the goodness out of that, but what you're doing there is not only good for them as clients in the future, but it's good for their life.
I love it. Ted, I have one more question for you, and it's a big one. I always like to ask my guests about their definition of success. Is it a destination? Is it a journey? And how do you know you're on track, you yourself?
Well, you know, Bogeyman, I think success is certainly just a journey. Mm-hmm. I find different levels of success. First of all, I would say to people, if you are loved and cared for by your spouse and your children, and you have great relationships, that's a super high level of success to start with. That number one. Number two, I think everybody has to look at what you were given in life, your abilities. And if you take what you have and you do the best of your ability to do the best you can with that, it doesn't have anything to do with money for success. I know people in all facets, from a third grade teacher to everything, tell people that do philanthropic work, that are unbelievably successful. Do they make tons of money? No, but are they successful? Yes, they are very, very successful at what they do. And I think, to me, success is to be able to say, what did I do for the world? I have 2 really large foster child foundations. I'm getting ready to do another one this next year. And one of the things about that is that I don't talk about that very much, but you know what? That's giving good back in the world, and that's success. I mean, if you can put back in a lot to help people, then you're going to be successful. And so I see all levels of success, and I don't count it all with money. And a lot of people do, but I don't do that. I think success is you feeling like, you know what? I've attained something that nobody else has ever attained at what I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that is just wonderful for people to feel that way.
I like the sound of that. I can tell that you really enjoy what you do. You see it as a calling, much more than a profession or a job. And it really shines through your books and this conversation.
Well, thanks.
Well, Ted, this was a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot, and I hope the audience has a chance to discover your books and learn more about you and your thinking. So thank you so much for today.
Thank you, Bogeyman.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Sicard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.